Welcome to Anaesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name is Dr. Will Donaldson. I'm a consultant anaesthetist based in Northern Ireland and the current chair of the Northern Ireland Board of the Royal College. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Brano Mislevich, who is a consultant paediatric anaesthesiologist who works in the Children's Hospital in Crumlin in Dublin. So welcome, Brano. I really enjoyed the talk you gave at the session which I chaired. And you, by your own admission, you said at the start of the talk, you only had 20 minutes to talk about paediatric regional anaesthesia. How much of what you hoped to achieve did you manage to fit into that 20 minutes?
Thank you for a kind introduction, Will. And thank you for having me here. It's an honor to be here. And it was nice to have a presentation. So many, I presume it was mainly adult anaesthesiologists. And it was quite difficult, and actually I had the difficulty to shrink it down a little bit because I thought we'd run out of the time. And there were a few things I would have maybe changed, but overall I was trying to show like the pediatric anesthesia, it's safe, and many people can use it, and actually has many benefits. So it means it helping not only patients, but I think it might help also us to make our care easier.
And that came across. And you mentioned yourself that I think the majority of the audience at the conference will be adult anaesthetists, and I expect most of the audience of this podcast at home, that would be the same. So it would be interesting to me and hopefully to the audience if you could summarize the differences in regional anaesthesia for adults and children. Would that be okay?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, like there are... Usually people are a bit afraid to do regional on children, but I don't think it's justified. And the fear usually comes, the first is they are not familiar with the children, but the blocks basically are very similar, what we do in children and the adults. Usually the blocks are coming from adults. They tried it on adults, and then we start to use them as well. And the other difference is, of course, the pediatric patients are smaller, but the advantage of being smaller is also that the nerves are very, very superficial. It means they are easier accessible, you know, and also we usually put them in sleep, which sometimes the adult patient are not used to, and they feel it's not safe because they want to see if there is any reaction to the block when they're injecting. But in fact, is in children, sometimes it will be impossible to do the block if you don't put the patient to sleep. And this has been shown by multiple studies, and there was some advisory from many like profile anesthesiologists who said it is safe. And we some of us actually, I think we should be maybe doing in the bigger patient, we'll be able to do them awake, but we're so used to doing them asleep that they just do it. And a good example is like when I was talking about the spinal anesthesia in neonates, when we're not very used to it, but have a big benefit for these small patients.
That's very good. And I suppose just on the safety question, because that'll be of interest to those that practice adult anesthesia, I totally understand why you can't perform them awake, but do you use any other additional safety measures? Do you measure injection pressures in line when you're injecting, or do you, anything such as that?
We don't have that, but very often, I try to teach also, and also use myself the bigger syringes, because the common sense would say like the smaller the syringe, the better. And we actually used to the small syringes because the doses we're giving are quite small. You know, so that's why we use small syringes. But I try to explain that the smaller the syringe, the higher is the pressure. You know, so if you use like 10, even 20 mil syringe, it's better. Even it looks like you're giving too much or something, you know, but you feel the pressure much better.
That's a sound physical principle that will be very familiar to people who've sat the primary FRCA. So I hadn't thought of that. It's excellent. It goes without saying, because I saw your talk, but we haven't mentioned it so far, that you're almost exclusively using ultrasound. Yeah. For pediatric blocks. In what ways does ultrasound make it easier in a child than maybe in an adult, where some of my colleagues are still using landmark-based techniques or electrostimulating techniques?
I think it's similar to adults. I don't think it's too much different, but I, you know, you get used to it, and I'm sometimes thinking like it's similar when we weren't using the ultrasound for the central venous access, you know, and now it's like nobody even think about it. I think it is very similar. Like, I remember my colleague was saying, he was older colleague, and I was talking to him, and I told him, like, it's not safe to do the vascular access anymore without the ultrasound. And he told me, does it mean that we were doing in 30 years it wasn't safe? You know, so that's kind of question, that's the kind of approach, you know. So some people just think, I have been doing this for a while, so why would I need the ultrasound?
Yeah, you know? that's very common. I mean,
yeah,
without veering off piece too far, I mean, when ultrasound guided venous access was first brought in, there were disasters because people didn't know how to use it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think the point is that you can't pick up a piece of equipment and naively expect. So certainly, I'm sure you teach people what anatomy to expect to see before they put the probe on. And, you know, as somebody who likes learning these techniques, you need to see people doing them. You need to understand the anatomy. You need to watch videos. Videos are very important.
Yeah.
And you showed a couple of good videos. If we flip back to some of the benefits, I know you touched on, say, for example, opioid reduction in children, because I remember you saying that there's a narrow therapeutic window, particularly in very small children. Avoiding opioids would therefore presumably be a good thing. Is that what you find in your experience?
Yeah, definitely. Like, for example, we have patients who are particularly like sensitive to opioids. Like, for example, if you're doing the pyloromyotomy, it means they're in the high acidosis, alkalosis before the surgery. So it means they're less sensitive to CO2, you know, and that usually lasts a little bit longer. So it means if you give them opioids, they don't react to the high CO2 that much, you know. So they just need much more, and that's why it's not recommended to give them any opioids. So we try to avoid it, and how do you avoid it? The best is just do regional or even if they are doing the infiltration with local anesthetic. Anything we can do basically helps, you know. So, and also you can do it, like I said, you're doing mandospinal. It means that they don't need any other drugs, you know. And, yeah.
And this is a slightly controversial question, but
yes.
as an avid follower of regional anesthesia in adults, it seems to me that the last 15, 20 years, everybody has decided to come up with their own named block for slightly similar parts of the anatomy. And actually, to what extent do you think, as pediatric regional anesthesia has followed adult anesthesia, you've benefited from, for example, the new blocks on the kids paper? Is somebody rationalizing this into something a jobbing anesthetist can actually get hold of and understand?
No, I think that the new blocks are actually great, and I think what's great on the ultrasound is like you can do so many things even on your own. You know, like, for example, I didn't have time. I had it first in my first preparation, but then I just removed it because it was too many. And it was the ESP block, which we normally use, and I think is a plain A block in adults. So, but we sometimes have patients after the spinal surgery who have instrumentation in. So basically can't do the ESP block, which I think is great for posterior surgery. I'm not sure about the anterior ones, but I think for posterior surgery works great. But we couldn't do the ESP block because the instrumentation was there, the transversus process was removed, so you can't basically do the classic one. So we just moved it a little bit more lateral, and we just touched the rib instead of the transversus probe and inject it and see how it goes. And we had like 6 patients that they needed very little anesthesia. It means you're probably in the same plane and you just inject, you know. But if you didn't have ultrasound, you probably wouldn't have done it, you know. So you can add even your own kind of blocks, and you might be almost in the same area, but you're doing it a little bit differently. I think this is also coming with the new block. So we're just targeting different areas and in different situations, you know.
So, I mean, it goes without saying that a sound knowledge of the anatomy is important, but yes, if you know that well and you have an ultrasound, you can maybe extend the margins of where you access that anatomy, and that's a good example of that.
Yeah.
There was a question in the conference here today at Belfast about paravertebral blocks and safety, and I think you quoted an instance of pneumothorax between 0 and 1%. So
yeah.
That's the quoted incidence for a for a landmark paravertebral block, as far as I recall. So is ultrasound a lot safer than what we did before?
I think it is. Like, they're saying it's 0.5 to 1%, but I'm actually not sure now how much is it for the ultrasound. You know, it might be a bit less. The problem is that that you're quite close to the pleura anyway, you know, even if you use the ultrasound, you know, so it might happen. I don't recall anything like that. But again, I said the same I said on the conference. Like, very often you use the paravertebral block on the situation when there is already chest strain anyway, because it's usually big surgeries on the chest, you know, and that's what is the most helpful. And the same I was saying in the conference is, like, many people are afraid of the paravertebral of the pneumothorax. They are not afraid of the epidural. And if you're doing the epidural, you're doing it in thoracic area. It means you have vital spinal cord just beside it, you know. And there were some, I remember, and when I saw it, I was really scared that there were some incidents and I think it was in pediatric when there was, like, devastating injury, and they didn't know what it was from. You know, they're suggesting maybe it's from adrenaline. They added the adrenaline, so maybe it was like vasoconstriction or something. And then, you know, doesn't happen very often. But if you just one child is needed, that would be disaster, you know, if something like this happened. But the paravertebral, you do pneumothorax, so maybe patient stays in the hospital maybe a little bit longer. But it's not only that, it's also that you have more advantages. Like, for example, I said they don't need urinary catheter. You know, if you do epidural, it might happen then you're actually covering the other side, not the side you want. You know, like if you have a big surgery, a big laparotomy, of course you're putting the epidural. But you have one-sided, and I think it's especially on the chest, I think the paravertebral is much better. We should go for something which is at least equally effective and maybe with less side effects, rather than doing something which we used to, you know, I would do a paravertebral rather than the epidural. And also we have a surgeon who is able to put the paravertebral, especially for the small kids, and it's a big help because we don't have to do it. The problem is sometimes the catheter is in the area when they doing the incision. It means you can't do it beforehand, so he just does it for you, and if it does it well, it's great, you know, so you don't have to. You have the advantage, and the risk is much smaller because he's doing it under revision. So there are a few things you can do. You just need to think about it.
And that highlights really the importance of teamwork, I suppose, and as well as multimodal analgesia.
It's been called Scotland's best-kept secret. Dr. Gray's Hospital in Elgin, where consultant anaesthetists come for hands-on medicine and the life that works for you. Families settle quickly here. With affordable homes, good schools, beautiful scenery, and even whiskey distilleries nearby. Sunnier and drier than much of the UK, it's well connected too. London, Dublin, Amsterdam, an hour's flight. Make a life, not just a living. Go to wishyouworkedhere.scot and arrange a visit to see for yourself. Flights and accommodation covered. That's wishyouworkedhere.scot.
In an ideal world where, for you, pediatric regional anaesthesia really takes off, there's a lot of planar blocks now, some of which you described in your talk. To what extent do you think an increase in the use of planar blocks will decrease use of, for example, caudals or other neuraxial techniques?
I think it's increasing, and it's very important, and I think then we realize what is the best block for the each operation. You know, in the past, and I understand the caudal is a great block. I think it's very good skill to have. You can use it for so many surgeries. But on the other hand, if you have something which is, for example, higher in the abdomen, you can give caudal, but the problem is that it's going to last very short time. You know, that's the first thing, is going to disappear, so it's not covering what you want. If you don't have any other skills, or you're afraid or something, it's better. It's good to do it. But now we have much better technique, which are covering the areas, like, for example, I said this external oblique intercostal block, and it's quite easy to put the catheter there, and you cover him only an area you want, you know. So I think it's replacing it already. At least, like, I'm lucky that we have even like a newer and younger anesthetist, and they are very interested in the regional. So we have kind of group now. Then we're working together and we're sharing like what we've done and so on. So I think it's evolving, and in the one hand, we should do these A blocks, which are important and people do more and more. But on the other hand, if there is a better block, I think we should go for the better block, because always we should do something which is beneficial for a patient and
sort of extend the analysis that you look after have. Do you use a catheter technique, and you know, how easy are they to manage? Do you do it as an ambulatory? Do children ever go home with a catheter, as some adults do for some procedures?
No, we don't. Unfortunately, we don't. I know in France they do it quite a lot, which I think it would be great if you do something like that, but unfortunately we don't have anything like that. But that's why we should use the technique with the patient who's sending home. It's beneficial to give a block which is going to last for quite a long time. You know, so for example, if you do sciatic block, then there's a good chance it's going to last for 24 hours. You know, so if you send the patient home, it's unlikely he'll come back with the pain. But if you're giving caudal, and after 4 or 6 hours the pain comes back, you know, then it's more difficult. So that's why I think it's important then using the technique which provide analgesia longer rather than something. I sorted this out, I did my block, I transfer the patient to surgical day unit, and then they can send the patient home and give him some medication and see what happens, you know.
You mentioned my last question about indwelling catheters and ambulatory procedures and about colleagues in France doing this. So to what extent does the concept of networks exist for pediatric regional anesthesia? Do you take part in a network? Would you like to? Do you think it would be useful?
Yeah, it would be definitely. I think it would be useful. We don't have much connection. We have a very good connection within the French group, because the one in Istitis was working in Kremlin, and we used to organize, we call it Franco-Irish meetings. So we kind of were doing it together, and we have like one day of the lectures, and then we have workshops as well. I think it worked pretty well. We still have the connection, but kind of we don't do it annually when we used to. But it's good to see like their approach is a little bit different, or what they're doing differently, and how they the French and France, I think they're very good. Even if you see it in the audit, I was showing that the France is quite high. They're quite used to it, and they are very good in it. So I think it would be good. I mean, we're actually thinking with the French group, maybe we should set up something like the community, or maybe some organization that they would cover something like this, because the more and more people are interested in it. But there are people like have connections, but I don't think there is actually formal anything like that, as far as I know.
I just think that you seem to be one of a number of pioneers in this area, and it would be great if there was collaboration. I know it's collaboration in a research basis, but I mean, you talk about people doing different techniques that seem to work well. Ask the question, why do your kids get to go home with an indwelling catheter? What are you doing differently? And perhaps, you know, on a trial basis, bring it into your institution. I was thinking more of a network across Ireland as the Republic of Ireland, but perhaps across Ireland and the UK. I'm sure lots of our listeners would be very interested to maybe take part in such a thing. I think one thing we haven't touched upon is parents, and to what extent, because I have some appreciation for all the work you do, and some of these unfortunate children come for repeat procedures, so presumably you get to know parents over time. Do you get feedback about the impact of regional anesthesia? Perhaps parents have been looked after by a different anesthesiologist and then they see you. Have you had any experience of that?
I remember, for example, one orthopedic, it's kind of about the parents and the surgeries. I remember the orthopedic surgeon, and she was very enthusiastic about the whole regional thing. And she actually told me that, for example, sometimes they need to do the frames, you know, the frames, they need to extend the legs, you know, and they put the frames, and they sometimes they do need to do it on one side, and then they coming later to the other side. If they had a block on the first side, they're much more keen to come for the second time. If they don't, then they were sore and they're kind of delaying it. They don't want to come. They have excuses and so on. So she definitely said she can do the reference, and she was always looking for a block because she knew it was great. And sometimes even if you put a catheter, for example, they need to adjust it later on the ward, and it was difficult to do it without the block, but with the catheter in, you just maybe top up a little bit and just do it on the ward. And once I remember, and it was probably one of my best experience with the original, was it was a pain patient, and she came like with the crutches, and she couldn't walk because she had some injury on the ankle, and she had it like for 6 months, and nobody could help her, and she they couldn't. So they just asked me if I'd put a block. So we did a block, but we put a catheter. And we kept the catheter for about 5 days. The advantage was that they were able to move the ankle, obviously, properly with the physio. And after 5 days, she started walking. She didn't have any crutches. She went home, and she sent me a letter, like changed her life and everything.
That's so fabulous. And just, yeah. I suppose, to get technical, what block would you do for that, or did you do for that?
So it's sciatic block. It was sciatic block and the adductor canal. So she had like two catheters, and we kept it for 3 days, and she was still a bit sore. So we extended to 5 days, and after 5 days, she was much better, and she was able to walk and everything.
Oh, well done. That's fascinating. Yeah. Coming back to your talk, which I really enjoyed, and also given what we said at the start, that you said there was an enormous amount that you could talk about. What would you want the listener to this podcast to take away from this? And the, you know, the people that are really interested are maybe the people that are looking after children on a regular basis but don't do regional anesthesia. How do they get into what you're doing?
Hmm. I think there's great benefit in regional, and I think it's even more benefit in children than in adults. And I think maybe what is similar to between adults and children is, I think the more difficult patient it is, the more he benefits from the regional. And also, like a small babies, I said, they are very sensitive to opioids, so they stop breathing, and at the same time they soar, you know. So how you fix that, you know? So the best is just block the pain with something else rather than with the opiates. The problem is we're facing, and that's becoming less and less, is like people and nurses are very used to the opioids, you know, so they just want to have a morphine, and they're happy with the morphine. They don't kind of see the problem. So I understand the people. I need to kind of fighting against this, because sometimes you might have a patient who is awake and he's thrashing around the bed, but in the same time, it doesn't mean that he's sore, you know. So when you give him the block, then you provide him in analgesia, but obviously you don't give him sedation. So sometimes it might be a good idea. For example, I like to add the clonidine. I do it very often, you know, like even to epidural or paravertebral, or even to the single shot, you give a little bit of clonidine. It means just settling them down a bit. But this is what I think is important. If you use these techniques, they have much less side effects, and they have big benefits, you know. So why wouldn't be doing it? You know, that's not the question. Why do it? Why not to do it? You know.
Yeah, I know. And you're a convert. So, yeah. But what I'm reading from that is that if I was going to embark upon setting up a pediatric regional anesthesia service, it's actually not just about training the anesthetist. It's actually more about educating the team as to the benefits, and that would absolutely be surgeons, nurses in theatre, but from the example you've given, recovery nurses as well. So it's a collaborative approach, and that's very, very interesting.
On the other hand, also you see the nurses on the ward with their experience and the differences, and also a pain nurse is very often they're telling me, like for example, if they're epidural and then we put some peripheral nerve catheter, they see the difference. They see like with epidurals they get called very often, but for peripheral nerve catheters they don't, and they, you know, they have less effects on the children. It means they can move, they don't have urinary catheters, and nurses don't have to care about it, you know. So it's only about something we don't know. We don't know why do we need to do this, why don't we just give them morphine, or why don't we do epidural, you know. So, and it's the same, we're going a certain way, and we're just trying to improve the things, and it's not always easy, which we understand.
It just remains for me just to thank you firstly for a fabulous talk today at Belfast at Anesthesia 2025. Really enjoyed it. I know lots of friends here who enjoyed your talk as well. I really appreciate your company for this podcast. I hope that the audience are as enthused by your interest in regional anesthesia for children as I have been. Brano, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bill. Thank you for having me.
And thanks as well to the listeners. Thank you for listening to this podcast. We'll have more information and some useful links in the episode description. For more podcasts like this, make sure you subscribe to Anesthesia on Air, and please, whilst you're there, give us a review.
Hi, I'm Dr. Catherine Bernard, one of the anaesthetists in training representatives on the RCOA Council, and the clinical content lead for Anaesthesia 2026, which is going to be beside the seaside at the Brighton Centre from the 12th to the 14th of May. If you enjoyed this special conference podcast episode and want to join us online or in person for some inspiring speakers, hands-on workshops and world-class anaesthesia education, book your place at Anaesthesia 26. If you book before the 30th of December, you can get a 20% discount. Enter the code EARLY20, that's EARLY20, all capitals, no spaces, during the checkout. There'll be a booking link in the description. We can't wait to see you at Anaesthesia 2026.